Jack Cashel's work may sound like it parallels the work of Peter Lance. You remember him from Triple Cross, and we've had more than a few conversations with Peter Lance over the years on a World Trade Center bombing number one connected to Flight 800 and then to 9/11. And yet, I don't think, just because you will hear some things about what Jack Cashel is saying that might sound like something that was in Peter Lance's book, that they are in total agreement on everything. In fact, I'm very curious to find out more about what Jack Cashel's been coming up with long after other people have taken their eye off the story on both Flight 800 and how it still connects to today's headlines. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, Jack Cashel, I could read your bio as I have it here in front of me, but I don't think it answers all the questions. For example, congratulations on winning those Emmys. But what did you win an Emmy for?
Actually, I won an Emmy for a documentary I produced called The Royal Years, which is, you know, pretty benign. It was about the history of the Kansas City and the Kansas City Royals.
Oh, congratulations, though. Oh, that's cool. Anything connected to baseball, you got my props on that. But what got you started on Flight 800?
Well, you know what happened is I had not done any of this kind of investigative reporting before 2001. And that was the year I just happened to go to a talk given by James Sanders and his wife, Elizabeth. James was the original investigative reporter who got into Flight 800, and he wrote a book called The Downing of TWA Flight 800. And at dinner afterwards, I went to dinner with him, and I sat next to his wife, Elizabeth, who's a Filipino-American, just a sweetheart, just pretty nice. You know, she could be your sister, or your mother, or your wife. And after talking to her, when I realized that she and James had both been arrested and tried and convicted of conspiracy, that there was something wrong with this case. So I approached him about doing a documentary, which we did, which is called Silence. But before I got into it, I didn't want to waste my time on something that might have been or could have been or, you know, just a possibility. So I went down. They were living in Fort Lauderdale. I spent 3 or 4 days with them. I went through every bit of evidence they had. And then I went through all the counter evidence, you know, the mainstream reports of what was supposed to have happened. And when I left there 3 or 4 days later, I was 100% convinced that missiles were fired on the night of July 17, 1996, off the coast of Long Island. And those missiles were responsible for the destruction of TWA Flight 800.
Arrested, tried, and convicted for the conspiracy of what?
Well, this is a shocking and it's a sad and terrible story, especially as it relates to the American media. But see, Elizabeth Sanders was a trainer and flight attendant for TWA, and 53 TWA employees were killed on that airplane crash, and she knew half of them. She trained them, and she was heartbroken, and she was going from one memorial service to another. And at one of those services, a pilot, a 747 pilot, in fact, he was the manager of all the 747 pilots, who was working at the investigation site on Long Island, approached Elizabeth Sanders, and he said to her, "Is your husband still an investigative reporter?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Have him contact me." And this fellow's name was Terry Stacy. And so Jim Sanders contacted Stacy. They started a relationship, and Sanders was looking for someone who was a total straight arrow, someone who would, was not a sensationalist or a guy who was looking for attention. And Stacy was exactly that guy, the kind of guy who doesn't say anything unless he absolutely means it. And they met for the first time in New Jersey, in confidence at a restaurant. And the first thing that Stacy said to Sanders was, "Jim, there's a cover-up going on." And from that moment on, they began work together to unravel the cover-up. Now, what happened was, where they got into trouble, or where they were forced into trouble, was when Stacy told Sanders that there was a residue, orange-red residue on the back of all these seats right across the center of the plane. And he had tried to get it tested, but the FBI wouldn't give him results. So Sanders said to Stacy, the pilot, he said, can you scrape off some of that residue? Send it to me, and I'll have it tested. And he did. He went in to scrape it off, but it wasn't scrape. So he took a pinch of foam rubber out of the back of one of these seats. You know, there might have been a thousand pinches that he could have taken, but he took one, sent it to Sanders by way of Federal Express, and then Sanders had it tested. It proved consistent with rocket fuel, and Sanders went public with his results, and when he did, you know, the world came down on the heads of the Sanders and Terry Stacey, and they arrested them for conspiracy to steal airplane parts. And this is a law that had been written to protect against scavengers at the crash scene.
This part I remember. Suddenly now that part I just wasn't sure. Now I now that you put it in that context, let me push back a little bit when you talk about the positive for rocket fuel as opposed to jet fuel. Is there a definitive difference that? There's no doubt in anybody's scientific mind. If they still had a piece of that foam rubber, that one would test for rocket fuel, but not for jet fuel. There's no way those two things could be confused.
Well, actually, what the FBI, after James Sanders went public, the FBI said it was glue. But that's all it was glue. And yet they confiscated the pieces that Sanders had given to 60 Minutes. They arrested him and Stacy for this glue, and other people had it tested independently. It was not glue. You know, they said it was this 3M product. It was not. And what Sanders said consistent with, the lab he took it to said, I can't tell you for a fact that it's rocket fuel. I mean, that would take another level of test. But all of the elements that you'll find in the fuel of a rocket is here in the of a missile is here in this element and in this product you've given me. And it was at that point that the authorities came down on them like a ton of bricks. If it was just glue, you think they'd have just blown them off. Right. But they knew it was more than that because the FBI had it tested early on, and they wouldn't share the test with Stacy, who was working at that time for the National Transportation Safety Board, the head 747 pilot.
Right.
And that's where it all, that's where it began. That's how I got involved in this. And the deeper I got involved, the more I began to see that the at the, you know, we were at the point of making a documentary going into August and September of 2001 for a big national distributor who wanted to sell it to BBC, and then September 11th happened, and then we realized that this wasn't just some unconnected incident, but that there were consequences, terrible consequences for shutting down this investigation, and I am convinced that had we told the truth about TWA Flight 800, September 11th wouldn't have happened.
Well, I sure want to spend more time on that. I should stop, though, since we're talking, this whole conversation got started talking about your bio, and it would be unfair for both for me and to the, you know, to your parents, who no doubt suffered through some of this, not to mention that you are a doctor, too, on top of this, right? You
have
your
PhD. Yeah, from Purdue University. Go Boilers.
Should I be calling you Dr. Jack
no,
Cashel?
No, don't do that. If you call me doctor, you expect me to take your appendix out. That goes wrong.
Yeah. Okay, as long as you're not taking my temperature, I'm okay with that. All right, so the as you look into this, though, what is that key part that when you say after 9/11, you saw this connection, you started to see these big pieces sort of tumbling together? That would imply that you've got worked out for sure the players of Flight 800 and, or you know, the co-conspirators in Flight 800's bringing down Flight 800. How does that play into 9/11?
Well, the real you know, and I will not tell you for sure. I could tell you exactly who the players were on Flight 800. I'll tell you what I know and what I think I know.
Okay.
What I know is that missiles were fired. What I don't know for sure is who fired them.
Right.
However, I do know the dynamics of that date, what was going on that date. Most of the other people who were looking into Flight 800 were technical people, and they were looking at airplane parts. And I'm a dot connector, and I started looking back and forth. I'm a historian. I tried to look at how this fit into the larger picture of Mideast terrorism. And I began to see a pattern that started with the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, if not before. And we see the same players involved in the first World Trade Center bombing, in TWA Flight 800, and in 9/11. Now, the mastermind of the World Trade Center bombing, the first one, is a guy named Ramzi Youssef. That's the name we know him by. The mastermind of 9/11 is a guy named Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's allegedly Ramzi Youssef's uncle. The people who were involved, and Peter Lance, as you mentioned, has done a lot of good reporting about the Youssef connection to 800.
Right.
This is the same people. And the authorities would have us believe this is just one family. A family, by the way, that's not even particularly, Islamic. I mean, these guys have girlfriends. They go to discos. They go to karaoke bars, you know. They come from a part of the world that has no grudge against the United States. The question is, who hired these people? And there's one word. I have to thank Peter Lance. He's the first mainstream reporter to talk seriously about TWA Flight 800. He deserves credit for that. But in one way, he's like other mainstream reporters in that there's one word he leaves out of this conversation. And for a variety of reasons, they refuse to talk about it, and yet it's at the heart of it. And that word is Iraq. And when we look at the connection between these conspirators and Iraq, we begin to be able to put this whole picture together, and we begin to see why this danger, curiously, still looms, even in the even after Iraq has been, pacified.
Well, pacified, not quite. But
yeah, I mean pacified in the sense of, Saddam has been.
Saddam has been pacified,
and,
it's safe
Uday
to say.
And Kirsay, you know.
Right, right.
But the bad guys are still out there.
All right, so then as a professional dot connector, take me through the, as you sketch it out, from the events after the first World Trade Center bombing through Flight 800, through the conspiracy of Flight 800, as best as you can tell, and how that plays into both Iraq and eventually 9/11, because so many other investigators would say Iraq and 9/11 have absolutely nothing to do with each other.
Well, they have a professional interest in saying that, and that goes back all the way to the first World Trade Center bombing. I'm going to start this story in 1872, of all times.
Well, we may not have a time to connect enough of those dots before the break.
Then I'm going to jump quickly 150
okay.
years in the future.
All right, go ahead.
1872, Iran annexes Balochistan. This is this bizarre, country that straddles the border between Iran and Pakistan. In the southeast coast there. And the Baluchis are strange, fierce people. They're Sunni Muslims. The Iranians are Shiites. They hate each other. Okay, let's jump ahead now 100 years, 110 years. It's the Iraq-Iranian War. Those were the days, right?
Right.
All the bad guys fought each other.
Right.
And the Baluchis were recruited by Iraqi intelligence, since they were Iranian citizens. Technically, to sabotage, to fight against Iran. And what they developed in Baluchi was a hard core of really serious, competent, tough-minded terrorists.
And I want you to stop 1 second, because when you say Baluchi, it makes it sound like that's a state within Iran, or because it's no longer a sovereign country by the time?
No, it's no longer a sovereign country. It's sort of like Kurdistan, these nationality places that used to have a certain sovereignty and don't any longer.
But kind
so
of a
half
rough.
Half of it's in Iran, half of it's in Pakistan, a little of it spills into Afghanistan.
Kind of a province.
Right, but they identify strongly, and they have their own language, Baluch. And oddly, John Belushi has his name. He may be from there because he looks just like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
he does, actually. now that you mention it.
All right, they're built alike.
I thought Belushi was Albanian, but...
No, you're right. He is Albanian.
go ahead.
They developed this fierce core of intelligence operatives, who, dirty tricksters who were operating during the Iranian-Iraq war on behalf of Saddam, but they're, as far as I could tell, freelancers. I mean, they're looking now they have a set of skills, and they want to put them to work. We move ahead then to 1992. This is the year when the first World Trade Center bombing plot is hatched. And what I'm going to tell you now is a series of facts that are indisputable. I mean, that there's no denying them. I'm not making them up. But the plot starts in June of 1992 when a guy named Mohammed Salameh calls his uncle. And he's the first of 46 calls he's going to make to his uncle. He's a PLO operative, and he just happens to be in Baghdad. Now, a couple months later, the first of the serious operators comes to the United States. The guy's name is Abdul Rahman Yassin. These names I'm just going to use once or twice and have to worry about remembering them. He gets his passport in Jordan because he was born in America, but he's an Iraqi. He's lived the rest of his life in Iraq. He comes to the United States in early September of 1992. In early September of 1992, another guy comes to the United States. This is Ramzi Youssef, the guy we talked about. Ramzi Youssef is a Baluchi. And he's traveling on an Iraqi passport. He comes from Baghdad. That's where his passport was last stamped. He arrives in New York City, and they begin to conspire. Now, on February 26, 1993, Youssef and his Yassin and this crew of like local yokels, they rounded up to do the dirty work for them. They drive their van to the World Trade Center, park it underneath. Youssef has constructed a cyanide-laced bomb. His plan is he parks it in this one corner of the one building. His goal is to have the one building topple into the other. His goal is to kill 250,000 people when the cyanide is released. He did not succeed in that. He failed only because he very nearly did, but the building proved more structurally sound than he anticipated. And six people were killed. We say only six people were killed, and hundreds were injured. And everyone remembers that bombing. Now, the two people who flee the country are Yassin, the Iraqi, and Youssef, who is known on the ground as Rashid the Iraqi, and is traveling on an Iraqi passport. All the locals are eventually caught and prosecuted as though they had done nothing worse than, like, shake a baby or something. You know, they were just common criminals. Yassin, Abdul Rahman Yassin, goes back to Baghdad. An ABC stringer interviews him there in 1994. He's working for the government, right? He's there 10 years later when we go into Baghdad. Now, I say all of this, and I mention all these Iraqi connections, because in all of the mainstream books on the First World Trade Center bombing, including Peter Lance's, but most notably Lawrence Wright's excellent book, The Looming Tower, he spends 20 pages on the First World Trade Center bombing. He does not use the word Iraq. And to not use the word Iraq means that he has to not even mention this guy, Abdul Rahman Yassin, the Iraqi who leaves the country scarred from chemical burns and is a guest of Saddam for the next 10 years. There's reasons for
that. What's the reason for that?
Well, the original reason, Ian, is because if we had acknowledged that Iraq was behind this in February of 1993, and we have a new president on the job for a month, we've got to do something significant in an international military way. In a sense, we almost have to go to war. If we treat it as a crime and hope it's just a once-in-a-lifetime thing, we can have business as usual. We can have peace and we can have prosperity.
Well, I want you to hang on to that thought, because that seems to have implications also for Bush 41 for not going into Baghdad. For ending the first Iraq war, essentially in the desert northwest of Kuwait. So, and something he always said he never regretted. But then, where does that put us for today? We'll come back to this. What connections then is Jack Cashel making between the events of Flight 800, the World Trade Center, where we are today in Iraq, and how we could have avoided 9/11. We're on it next on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Jack Cashel, and we'll get back to this conversation, making these connections on the days leading up to the anniversary of 9/11, about what Jack Cashel believes to be the connection between the first World Trade Center bombing, Flight 800, and both the war we are in now and how 9/11 could have been averted. He was just connecting the dots for us. We'll see what picture that gives us next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Jack Cashel, investigator who won an Emmy Award for a documentary on the Kansas City Royals, who might next turn his investigative skills toward figuring out what the hell happened with the Baltimore Orioles this season. for that matter, the Michigan Wolverines. You were just laying out for us the timeline. The World Trade Center bombing, number one, of the key figures of World Trade Center number one that had Iraqi passports, a fact that was not being amplified by the government in the hope that they could kind of redirect this World Trade Center bombing, not as an act of war, but just as an act of murderous, you know, criminal intent by terrorists.
Right. And not only did of the two main guys, one was an Iraqi and the other one was traveling on an Iraqi passport. But the date is interesting. The bombing took place on February 26th, 1993. Now, these are date-conscious people, as we all know, and sometimes they'll do date consciousness to the point of absurdity. And this will come up with Flight 800, too, as I'll explain in a few minutes. But on February 26, 1991, that was the day that the Iraqi forces were humiliatingly compelled to withdraw from Kuwait. It was the darkest day in Iraqi history. Saddam had vowed revenge. And then on the second anniversary, this bomb goes off, and we're not supposed to connect these dots, especially given the fact that these guys are, like you said, one guy's an Iraqi, one guy's on an Iraqi passport. The first plot was started with 46 phone calls to Baghdad, yet for a variety of reasons, and the reasons have changed. But at the time, the reason was the reason of state. Yeah, we don't want to go to war unnecessarily. Only six people died. Let's call this a crime. Let's round up the locals who are involved, the blind sheik and all of his henchmen, the guys who've mixed a few chemicals, arrest them, have a trial, and call it a day. Unfortunately, the day wasn't over.
Well, could it be that the government didn't want to say that it was an act of war because they didn't want to give Saddam the satisfaction, the international satisfaction or the international prestige of having landed a blow on the chin of the U.S. government at the World Trade Center building?
That's a possible explanation. And yet there is an event that took place a couple months later that would make you think otherwise, and that is in April 93, when Herbert Walker Bush, 41, was visiting Kuwait to be honored. There was an assassination attempt on his life, almost assuredly plotted by Iraqi intelligence. And we responded by sending, like 60 cruise missiles into Baghdad. So we gave him credit for that, but not for the World Trade Center bomb.
Because that happened on foreign soil.
And it wasn't successful.
That's what I mean. It sort of seems like that's the kind of thing where you could say, ha-ha, swing and a miss, and then we come down with all those missiles raining down on Saddam. But if the government, and I'm just playing devil's advocate, but if the government had said this was an act of war done by Iraq, we just left. And it would also seem to highlight the fact that as George Bush 41 was still reeling from, hadn't finished the job of going in and getting rid of Saddam, so the claim was made, and President Clinton had no appetite for war.
No, that's exactly right. And, you're 1 month into your administration, and you want to fight the last war, Yeah, you don't want to do that. And so there are reasons of state for doing what they're doing. But unfortunately, the consequences of ignoring this is really a hardcore group of Baluchi terrorists, Ramzi Youssef being one of them, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was involved with the planning for this one as well, his alleged uncle, was that they were still on the loose. And here's something that also should be added, is that in all the research that's been done on the financing of the first World Trade Center bombing, it's transparent that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with it. He didn't know these guys at the time. In 1993, he didn't know them. He didn't meet them until about 1996. And He wasn't even on our radar screen until really 1998. We don't know who you know, formally, even the authorities will say, we don't know who sponsored this organization, this job. And it's an expensive job, into the multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right. But, aren't we led to believe that it's, that this was masterminded by the blind sheikh and that this was all his idea and it was due to his hatred of the great Satan?
Right, that's what we're led to believe, yes.
Okay.
But he didn't have that kind of money or that kind of wherewithal, And he wasn't in a position to, and Youssef, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed have been interrogated, and they both say that they don't pin it on the sheikh. They could. They might as well. He's been arrested anyhow.
Right.
They just say that certain friends of ours financed it,
All right. So so this gets passed off. We don't invade back to Iraq. We don't use that as anything, even though it might as easily been an act of war. And instead, how does that, play into what happens later on with Flight 800?
Well, this gets really fascinating now. And now I'm going to add another wrinkle here. Ramz Youssef is the master bomber. This is the World Trade Center 1 mastermind. He flees the country, with Yassin. Yassin goes to Iraq, and Youssef keeps traveling. In November 1994, Youssef goes to Cebu City, which is a radical Islamic stronghold in the Philippines.
Sure.
That same month, another figure shows up in Cebu City. That figure is carrying a book that's if I can find the name of it here, it's called the fascinating book, The Chemistry of Powder and Explosive. That's the book he took with him. Before he left, this person left his ex-wife an envelope with $20,000 in it that said, don't open this unless I don't come back.
Right.
This is November 94. That person's name is Terry Nichols.
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing. Peter Lance talked about this a little bit, too, and I'm not at all dismissing what you're saying. I hope it just verifies what you're saying, because I think that's really compelling. Here's little Cebu City, and look at the nexus of people that are coming through that end up being tied then to Oklahoma City and then to Flight 800.
Right, because, in fact, after Lance's book came out, Dana Rohrabacher, a congressman from California, finished his report. This came out in December 96. Which delved into this in great detail and added detail that Lance did not yet have, although Lance did great research on this, by the way, great on-the-ground research. He verified all the information I'm going to tell you. But as Rohrabacher did the same, what we know is that in December, Youssef goes to Manila, where he is joined by another Baluchi, a guy named Murad, who's a pilot, Abdul Hakim Murad, and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is there, too. They have an apartment in Manila where they're mixing chemicals for a plan that's at least the most public part of the plan we call Bojinka, which was Youssef's plan to blow up a dozen airliners more or less simultaneously over the Pacific. He'd already blown up a Filipino airliner. He knew he could do it. He had test run it, and he decided that he had to make his charge a little bigger, put it over the center fuel tank, but he killed one Japanese passenger, almost brought down the whole plane. So they're there now in December 1994. They're into January of 1995. And January 6th of 1995, a fire breaks out in their apartment when they're mixing chemicals. And, the landlady calls police, firemen. They come. Youssef tries to scare them off, but they're not to be scared off. Youssef takes off. Murad takes off. And then Youssef realizes he left his laptop back in the apartment. So, no fool, he sends Murad back to get it. And the police apprehend Murad and the laptop with all the plans on it, right? That same day, this is January 6, 1995, as the Rohrabacher report makes clear, inexplicably, which was their word, Terry Nichols decides it's time to get out of the Philippines.
Yeah.
And he hastily changes his plans and comes back to America.
On an unrelated story.
Yeah, right. It had nothing to do with it.
Right.
And as both Rohrabacher and even Richard Clark, the Clinton anti-terror czar, says, Terry Nichols went to the Philippines not knowing a thing about making bombs, and he came back with a whole lot of talent, He had to learn that someplace.
Right. So, I'd love to keep that as sort of a sidebar. Come back to the Terry Nichols thing on your feelings on that. But so the So what we know is then that this plan about bringing down planes, that later on, which we would recognize perhaps as being the blueprint for the 9/11 attacks, is also then, as Peter Lance and you are pointing out, a connection to this Flight 800. So bring us forward a little bit then from Cebu City
today.
Here's
the fascinating part. The part that people talk about is the Bojinka part, but that is the blowing up of the plane. But there was a second part. And this was only briefly hinted at in the formal plan, and that was they talked about, and this was part of the laptop that was seized. They had plans to take a small charter jet, fill it with explosives, and to fly it into the CIA building. However, when Murad was captured, the Filipino police started interrogating. And they don't play by Marcus Kingsbury rules over there, you know. So Murad is, at first, he's resisting. He's not talking. And then the Filipino police, they did something fairly clever. They took two of their guys who could pass. They dressed them up as Mossad agents and sent them in to talk to Murad and said, okay, Murad, we're taking you back to Israel. And Murad said, what do you want to know?
Since
Mossad doesn't play ball, doesn't play softball either.
Right.
Then Mossad spilled his guts about the plane's plot. And I'm just going to refer to this in the future as the planes plot, because that's sort of what's been known as. Basically, Murad was a pilot. At that time, now this is in 94, 95, he was in charge of training his fellow conspirators, sending the flight schools in America, because Murad learned in America also, how to fly airplanes. And he told them in January of 1995, he told the authorities in January 95, that they were planning on hijacking American planes and using them as bombs. They were planning on using charter jets, filling them with explosives, and using them as bombs and attacking American targets. This is in January of 95. This is beyond dispute. In other words, we knew about these plans 6 years before September 11th, and we sat on them. And there was one reason we sat on them, and that will come up later, and that's TWA Flight 800.
Okay. Well, let's not make it later, because you've got me. So I'm only using 10% of the chair I'm sitting on. So I'm fascinated. So how does that go through Flight 800 so that we don't use the plans? What is about what happens in Flight 800 that prevents us from connecting those dots?
Well, and let me take one more quick look at our sidebar in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
In April of 1995. This is 4 months after Nichols gets back from the Philippines. When Bill Clinton, president, hears about it, the first thing he says to Governor Frank Keating of Oklahoma, he says, God, I hope there's no Middle Eastern connection to this. Remember, the last thing anyone in Washington wanted, especially a president who was going for re-election on a peace and prosperity ticket, was war. And if Middle Eastern terrorists had done it, it would mean a major international brouhaha. You know, we're talking peace, we're talking prosperity. If we go to war, we don't have peace, and we probably don't have prosperity. So something's
right.
changed.
Right.
Let me jump ahead.
We have the economy we have now, which is a mixed blessing at best.
Right, exactly, because you're paying an awful lot of money. You know, I mean, it's expensive. But the whole mood for that year is that the whole period, Oklahoma City, World Trade Center, let's keep this stuff below the radar. Let's not make this a terrorist incident. Or let's keep it domestic, because that way we can, you know, go after our domestic enemies, like the NRA or whatever. And so then we move forward to July of 1996. And there's certain things going on in the air at that time. And I'm going to just jump ahead into July 17th, 1996, which is the day in question. The day begins with a fax that's sent to Al-Harabi, the main, the biggest English language, Arabic media source in London. And it's the way that these warnings are usually sent. And it says very specifically, you know, you foolish American president, we're planning a spectacular attack against America. And then it closes with this interesting line. Their time is the morning dawn. Is not the morning dawn near? I'm going to come back to that. This is on the very beginning of July 17th. There's also, so there's terror threats in the air. Here's the critical thing about July 17th. It is Saddam's evil 4th of July. It is their National Liberation Day. It's the day the Ba'ath Party took power, like 25 years earlier, and the day that, 10 years later, that Saddam himself took power, July 17th. When the American military came into Iraq, they found July 17th written all over the walls. That wasn't necessarily a reference to Flight 800. It might have been. But it was really a reference to the fact it's like the 4th of July. Now, for instance, if someone blow up, let's say on next 4th of July, Mecca was blown up, you'd think one of two things. Either we did it, or someone did it to pin it on us, but you wouldn't think it was an accident. You know, you wouldn't think in those terms.
It would be hard to think of the 4th of July or Christmas Day as a coincidence.
Yeah,
when
it's a coincidence. Exactly. Right. Same thing with July 17th.
Right.
Now, the American intelligence planners were aware of this. They had the planes plot for 18 months. They had gotten it from the Filipino police. They sent it to the FBI immediately. We were fully aware of this possibility. On July 19th, 2 days later, we were to start the feel-good Atlanta Olympics. That night, July 17th, given the terrorist threat, the terrorist environment, the 17th Saddam's day, he gives that day with authorities have called the most angry, vengeful speech of his entire life against the United States. The U.S. military is locked and loaded up and down the coast of New York and the East Coast. This is the highest state of alert, I'm told, since the Cuban Missile Crisis on the East Coast. But the Navy is out in full force. We know that. Now, let's move ahead a little bit. And there's a lot of things that could have happened. And I can't tell you absolutely what happened, but I can tell you how the mechanics of it proceeded. At the dynamic start at 8:19 that evening, TWA Flight 800, 230 people on board, leaves JFK, heading east to Paris. 8:30 at sunset, exactly at sunset. It's a beautiful, cool night. Everyone's out on the beach. The plane's path parallels the South Shore of Long Island, which is a very affluent beach summer community. That's where the Hamptons are, Fire Island, else, places like that that you've heard of. It's 12 minutes out of JFK, heading along the coast towards Paris, heading east, when the FAA air traffic controllers say, oh, my God, they see an object, and this is their word, merging with TWA Flight 800. This is what starts the official response that night. They immediately send that information to their headquarters in Atlantic City. Atlantic City faxes their data immediately down to Washington. Richard Clark, the anti-terrorism czar, the guy who wrote Against All Enemies, and is the only one indiscreet enough to talk about this, gets the call a half hour after the crash, come back to the White House immediately. He calls an emergency meeting of the counterterrorism security group, CSG, in the situation of the White House. Now, the Value Jet had crashed 2 months before that, and there was no situation meeting. There was no, powwows in the White House. That didn't happen. There was a plane crash. Planes crashed. This was different. They all knew it. This was before the eyewitness reports began to come in.
All right, hang on to that, because it can only get more fascinating from here. And I would nowhere along the line do I want to miss a word of this. And I think your point about ValueJet is well taken, too, because even though that had a very suspicious origin, it was a very unusual thing to happen. Even though that took time to reconstruct, and even though there was near total destruction of that plane in some respects, I guess not near as much as 800. There was no hint that that was a bomb. So let's go back and pick that up just in a second. The connection between World Trade Center bombing 9/11, Iraq, and Flight 800 next on Coast to Coast AM.